right. Thank you for attending this session. The Worth of Souls is Great: How the Theory of an Atheist Supports the Gospel of Jesus Christ in Promoting Psychological Well-Being. Before we begin, just want to remind everyone to turn your cell phones off and to be respectful in your comments. Remember, you can buy audio versions downstairs later this evening if you would like to. The session is being recorded, so just be aware of that with noises, and if you ask questions, to use a microphone. The session is 90 minutes long. We ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. The main assumption of rational emotive behavioral therapy is that humans have inherent value. Doctrine and Covenants 18:10 teaches that the worth of souls is great in the sight of God, but often aspects of LDS doctrine have been used to accuse and shame. This presentation will use REBT to explore how reconceptualization can promote healing. The presenters in this session are Misha McGriggs. She's a PhD candidate in counseling psychology at Brigham Young University. Her clinical training has primarily been in rational emotive behavior therapy. Tristan Roney is completing a PhD in counseling psychology at BYU. He received a master's degree in contemplative psychology from Naropa University in 2012. A second lieutenant in the Air Force, he plans to work as an Air Force psychologist in 2016.
So we are going to need participation. I know it's the end of the night and we're just getting ready to go home, but we're going to lecture a little bit and then we're going to do some breakout work, and because, you know, we're talking about therapy, so we got to do some stuff, right? Right, absolutely. So
Before we jump in, is anyone here comfortable singing a solo in front of the whole room? Well, that was dangerous. That was dangerous. I won't bother. No one? Really?
Yeah, what song?
You know Yankee Doodle? Oh, I wish we had that one. Yankee Doodle? Anyone? You can come up in two or three if you want. We need an opening hymn, though. This is something. No one?
I hear it with my son all the time. Like,
yes, Jamie.
Come on up, come on up. You're a hero.
Yes,
you are. Woo!
Saving
that. Buy Jamie's book downstairs.
So the song is in Hebrew, but we're going to use these. But are you okay with these words? Maybe I should ask you that first.
Okay.
All right. Well, I apologize to the rest of you if you're not. They're mostly okay.
All right. Do I have a soundtrack? A drum roll?
It's acapella.
Yeah, this is
we're
all you.
Start from
yeah, and it is being recorded.
Some folks like a happy state. This is the tune, right?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay. Striving for elation. Some folks like to masturbate, but I like masturbation. Masturbation, keep it up. Masturbation, dandy. Mind the go-tos, yup, 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 and with the shoulds be handy. Yes, I know I could create greater satisfaction, but I'd rather masturbate and keep my mind in traction. Masturbation, keep it up. Let its message fit good. Mind the go-tos, yup, 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 and should-hood leads to shit-hood.
Yeah! Woo! Thank you. That was awesome. Now I feel like we can really get started. And we didn't skip anything. Okay, where were we?
So that's an REBT hymn. And there's quite a few REBT hymns. And we're going to talk a little bit about REBT. We're going to talk a little bit about Albert Ellis and who he was. And we're going to talk about how it applies to the gospel of Jesus Christ and how we can actually... Thank you. And how we can actually use principles and scriptures to adapt our therapy to meet a cultural sensitivity, religiously adapting for our LDS clients. So that's, and then we'll do some breakout work. So, interesting.
Now, let's skip that for now. All right, so let's talk about Albert Ellis. Anyone here familiar with Albert Ellis?
Am I not loud enough? Is that better?
Oh, thank you. That's important. Okay, is anyone here familiar with who Albert Ellis was? And of those of you that know him, did you like him, or do you like who he was?
Okay. He was. Yeah, you're right. Personally, I think he turned out all right. Yeah, but that's probably a matter of opinion.
So Albert so let's, CBT comes out of REBT. So REBT is the first CBT. And Albert Ellis was doing REBT, on himself when he was a child and a teenager, and he didn't even know it. He had a really tough childhood. He was a sickly kid. He spent a lot of time in the hospital. He kind of had a wackadoodle mama. And he had some struggles. Because he was out of school and in the hospital a lot, he didn't have a lot of social interactions. And his friends were other kids at the hospital. And there usually weren't that many other kids at the hospital. So when he was in his teenage years, he wasn't really too great with the ladies. And he wanted to be good with the ladies because he wanted to date and have relationships and all that good stuff. So what he decided to do was a little experiment with himself. And he's from New York, and he went to the Botanical Gardens in New York, Manhattan, and he said, you know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to ask 100 women out on a date. And let's see how many of them, because look at him. Who could resist that face? No, he's adorable. I call him my boyfriend. I call him my first boyfriend. And then I have other boyfriends, like Aaron Beck's my second boyfriend, but Albert is my first boyfriend. But when he was a young guy, he wasn't really he wasn't like a model. So he was kind of awkward, and then he wasn't very handsome. So he thought, you know what, I need to get better at this whole dating thing, and I just got to put myself out there. So he went to the Botanical Gardens, and he asked 100 women out. And 99 of those women rejected him. They said, nope, no way, no thanks. And the one, they exchanged numbers, and they actually set up a date, and then she stood him up on the date. So here he is, and he's over 100. And what would that, for most of us, that would be pretty awful. That would be pretty devastating. That would be terrible. That would be a catastrophe, right? I've been rejected 100 times. I really must not be worthy of love or affection or relationship. And instead, what he came away saying was, I'm still here. I'm still here. I'm fine. That sucked. That wasn't fun. I wouldn't want that to happen again. But you know what? I can do it again. I can continue to ask women out. And he became quite the playboy. So it worked. And he went and he continued to ask women out. And he was married, but he was kind of a Rolling Stone. But he ended up calling this exercise he did was shame attacking. He said, you go and do the thing that you're afraid of. You go and you put yourself in the situation where you're going to be rejected. And you do it over and over again until you learn that you're okay. And so that, and then, after he got his training, he, started to say, which he was trained in psychoanalysis. And he was like, this is silly. You're spending way too much time talking about your mother. My mother sucked too. But I don't think that's the reason I can't get a date. And
no offense to any psychoanalysts.
Yeah,
out
no,
there.
No.
It's a wonderful way to do therapy.
And he's nicer than me. So Albert started doing these things before he had the language to name them in the theory. But the theory comes from Epictetus. And the famous quote is that men are not disturbed by things, but by things that happen to them, but what they make of things that happen to them, by the way that they think about those things, the way that they conceptualize those things. And he thought Epictetus was onto something. And he said, you know what? That is where we are going to, that's the quote we're going to use for our philosophy. And then he just built from there. And that's where we ended up. So,
all right, so the important thing to make sure that we actually live up to the title of our presentation here is that Albert Ellis was an atheist, and for the majority of his life, he was very not just atheist, but anti-religion. And he's, if he's known at all, it's for this quote that he considers religion to be childish dependency. So, so you've already got a little bit of background on him, but he did end up becoming very influential in psychology in general. When they did a survey in the, I believe it was in the 80s, he was ranked the second most influential psychotherapist, in history, ahead of Sigmund Freud, who you've probably heard of before. Nowadays, people may not be as likely to rank him that high on the list, but that doesn't mean that his influence is any less important. As Misha pointed out, his version of cognitive behavioral therapy was really the original version, and a lot of what Aaron Beck did later when creating the more well-known version of it is based on a lot of the very same principles.
Albert was, he was known for being a little bit mean. He really, he was kind of a jerk. He really was. But he wasn't mean to his clients, and he did a lot of therapy, and he did therapy up until months before he died. He was in his 90s when he died, and he did therapy 35 hours a week of therapy. I spent some time at the Institute, the Albert Ellis Institute, last summer, and that is no one even there that are young, the psychotherapists, can keep up with the work that he was doing. But he loved therapy, and he really loved his clients, and he really wanted to give them. He wouldn't say that he was concerned with relationship so much, but he really was, and he did an excellent job at it.
Do you want to talk about his relationship with religion?
Yeah. So he hated religion, and he thought it led to pathology. He thought that people were sick because of religion, and he kept that view for quite a while until a young postdoc student was he a postdoc or was he just out of the military? He was young in his career. Stephen Lars Nielsen, who was an LDS psychologist, graduated from school, either did his postdoc first or went to the military, I can't remember which one, and then he wanted to do some training with Albert Ellis. And he is our supervisor, and he works at BYU now, and they went back and forth, and he's this really religious guy, and he's like, well, I mean, I'm not that crazy, and like, I'm really religious and spiritual, and I think God's good. And they went back and forth for a long time, and you know, Ellis didn't budge for a long time. Eventually, Lars worked on him enough, and he budged. And his last statement on religion was that, before he died, his last public statement on religion was that, maybe it didn't cause pathology. He didn't think it was great, but maybe it wasn't so harmful as what he had thought previously. And that's because of the work of a Mormon LDS psychologist. And they wrote a book together, and about religiously oriented REBT. And so it's a big deal that Albert, this vehement atheist, wrote this book. Religiously adapted REBT?
Not an exciting title.
Do you have the title?
Yeah, Counseling
and
Psychotherapy for Religious Persons.
That's it. Good job, Adam. Adam wins the...
Come on up here, Adam. Yeah. Clearly you have some stuff to share.
I never read I've read the book, just not the title for some reason. Yeah. It's still a top seller at the Institute, actually. So that, which is interesting. I mean, the Institute sits on NYU's campus, and the fact that, like, you know, city people in New York are, like, buying this book up all of the time. It's one of their top sellers.
Yeah, Lars actually said he occasionally gets a royalty check for about $12, so big moneymaker. All right, so let's talk a little bit about what rational emotive behavior therapy is. From now on, I'll probably refer to it as REBT, so just keep that in mind. The general idea behind it is that irrational and dysfunctional ways of seeing the world kind of contribute to all of our problems. Not kind of, they do contribute to all of our problems. As it says here, there's a lot of self-defeatism and social defeatism that goes into these thoughts. And we are almost all guilty of them all the time. In fact, if you were to think about it right now, you could probably come up with 3 self-defeating thoughts you've had just today. Now, these irrational thought patterns tend to be very absolutistic in nature. I think we're going to talk more about what that means in just a second. We will, but it's probably on the next slide here. But what happens is these thoughts are not very flexible. They're black and white in nature. They're everything is either great or everything is terrible. I am a wonderful person or I am a horrible person. And if you're the kind of person who constantly thinks, I am a wonderful person, you probably don't need REBT. For the rest of us, when we occasionally have those thoughts, I am an awful person, or I am a failure at my core, the world is terrible, this is where REBT can really be helpful for you. And the way it does that is by recognizing these types of ideas as they come up in our daily thought patterns, in our conversations, even in our actions. We can start to challenge them. And in REBT, you don't just kind of challenge anything, actually. You do it with enthusiasm. You do it with vigor. Anyone who knows Lars or who knew Albert Ellis knew that they are tenacious. They never stop going at it, no matter how much it annoys the person they're talking to. And there was a reason for that. It's because it was effective in their minds.
So one thing that Albert Ellis believes is that therapy can be fun. I believe that. I think sometimes therapy is sad and hard and there's tears. Sometimes it can be fun. And so one of the things that, one of the first disputations that I use in therapy with clients about have to. So what is it that you have? Because that's the way we talk. We say, I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to go there, I have to do my homework. No, you don't. That is a lie. That is a lie. And so I say to them, the only thing I have to do is stay black and die. And they usually laugh, right? Because that's the only thing I have to do. I have to stay black, and then I have to die. Everything else, literally everything else with enough money, time, energy, connections, resources can be changed. We have options. You stop breathing, then you're going to have to die. And they haven't worked out changing race, which is great. It's a good thing. So that's the type of thing. And that's extreme, right? But it allows us to see the ways in which we use this type of language. It's absolutistic. I have to. I must. I should. Stop masturbating. Stop shooting on yourself. It's a mess, right? It's a mess. And irrational, the word irrational, I think that helps, and that's the way that Albert Ellis termed it, and that's, I think for us as therapists or academics or whatever, it's a good word that helps us understand what it means, but that's not a word that I use in therapy. So I don't ever tell someone, your thoughts are irrational, even though they are. I say, you know, is that helpful, right? Is that a helpful thought or is that not so helpful? I don't know. You know, you seem to be pretty upset, so maybe it's not so helpful. Just because then they don't get on the defensive, like, you're calling me crazy. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I just, some of those thoughts are not so helpful. So that's a distinction there.
So that's kind of hard to see. I apologize. But there are, the way that I like to look at it and the way that it's been taught to me is you kind of have 3 different categories of these thoughts. One of them are thoughts about yourself. One of them are thoughts about other people, and the last one is thoughts about just life in general, right? So as Misha was saying, we masturbate quite a bit. And in this first sense, that means I must be a certain way. In order for my life to be good enough, in order for me to be okay as a person, I must meet certain criteria. That might mean I must be nice at all times, no matter how mean other people are to me, or I must get an A on this test that I'm about to take. Whatever it is, we have that must. And when we don't live up to the must is when we start to suffer. That's when we start to think, well, since I didn't live up to my must, it clearly means that I am a terrible person or I am awful or everything is terrible. When it comes to other people, it's even more important to keep this in mind. We often have our day ruined by something that another person did to us because they must treat us fairly. They must be nicer than they've been to us. pattern goes on. And then in life in general, something happens to you. You get stranded in traffic on your way to work, and you say, this is unacceptable. I must not be late to work today. And because I am, everything is ruined for the whole day. And we go through these patterns over and over again, 100 times a day, in very, very small ways, very subtle ways that we're not even fully aware of. But we do notice the results of that, which is our mood starts to drop, right? We start to recognize that we're a little more irritable than we used to be. We start to say, wow, I really don't like myself very much. Or, gosh, people really annoy me all the time. I don't like being around other people. Enough of that builds up over time, and you can actually get yourself to a place where you would qualify for a diagnosis of major depressive disorder or anxiety, right? Anything else on that one? Okay. So we're going to start. We're going to start getting into some of the fun stuff here in a minute.
Yes. One more thing would be that in our title we do talk about the worthless souls is great. And that's because, so that this kind of foundation is that we upset ourselves, right? Because we're trying to achieve this worth, this value. I remember my first day of supervision with Lars. I said something about worth, and he was like, oh, like I said something like individual worth, and like, you know, my little whatever young woman Mormon like speak, and you know he'd been using value, and that was just like an adaptation that I made subconsciously. It wasn't something that I aimed to do or anything like that, but because of my context and where I've come out of, when you're saying value, the value of human life, to me it just connects up with the scriptures. It just goes, I go right to DNC, and I don't think, oh, I'm thinking about the scripture. It's just value and worth. And so that's one little adaptation. We'll talk about that more. But that's one little adaptation. So really, Albert Ellis believed in worth, in this inherent value and worth that each of us have. We all have it. It's just there. And what we're doing, right, is constantly attempting to prove it and to have approval of it. And when you let that go, then you can really start to function in a healthy way and to think in a way that allows you to be healthy. Because if I don't have to be perfect or I don't have to do all these things, then I can just do instead of stew. That's another song. Do, don't, stew. I can't remember the tune. But anyway. Did we lose it?
Apparently we're updating.
We're updating.
So we're...
It must reboot. That's right. We catastrophize.
So
do we
speaking
have a slide
of
about ABC,
we're that was coming up. Okay. Please do.
Not worth, but value, and in that, yeah, I mean, basically, a lot of other, well, client-centered people would say, like, you deserve this unconditional positive regard, and that's along the same lines as what Albert would have said, but again, I mean, he's saying this stuff, we have to put it in a time, right, so he's saying this stuff when Freud is saying other stuff that's not that, right, like you have to, if you're like almost like karmic, like, well, you need to do all these things so that you can have relationships, like you need to be in this place where you can give so that you, because you do deserve that to say that you're worth something and that you have some value. And I mean, that's kind of seems to be the theme in some of the early psychodynamic. I don't think so much now, but in that early psychodynamic thought. And when he comes in and he's just like, no, like, you don't need to have relationships. And like the only reason that you have these relations is to propagate your species. If you don't want to propagate your species, then don't have relations, but you don't need to have love. You don't need to have relationship to have value. You already have it just because you're breathing air. It's there. It's already there just because you're breathing air. Now, it might be nice to have a loving, co-beneficial relationship, but you don't need it to live. You don't need it to live.
So, yeah, it's fair to say that this particular concept is not unique to REBT at all. It's very common in the world of psychology, especially today. But it is worth pointing out that it's a concept that's highly emphasized. And in addition to this idea, one of the terms that they use for it often is unconditional self-acceptance, right? And a corollary idea that is always emphasized in REBT is unconditional other acceptance. That is, acceptance of other people as unconditionally as you're able to accept yourself. Because as we'll start to learn going forward, other people are extremely difficult to control, as hard as we try to do that. And when we think that we should be able to control them, it creates a lot of frustration for us.
Or if we act in a certain way, then other people should react to us in a certain way. Right? Yeah. Right. Sorry, guys. We have a list, but I am tone deaf, so.
Well, and I guess with what you're saying about unconditional self-acceptance and acceptance of the other as well, that is the second great beginning.
Right.
Right? And that's, I feel like, where something that anyone can agree on, no matter where you are on the spectrum of the week, and I really like that.
That's a great adaptation. Yeah, that's how it's done. Because I could say, you know, I could say to a client, you know, accept yourself and accept others, but when it's put into their language, met where they are in their context, here's a little more weight. And because Tristan and I have been working at BYU for 2 years in the counseling center, that's something that we're constantly doing, is looking for ways to speak the language of our client. The reason I think that it's important to make these adaptations is because I believe in multicultural competence and sensitivity and adapting our therapy to meet the client where they are. And for the majority of our clients, the majority of which are Orthodox LDS folks, it's kind of a go-to. So we'll talk more about that, though.
All right, so for this next part, let's start doing a little more interaction here. So there's this concept that Misha talked about called, it's the helpful and unhelpful emotions. And it can be a little bit challenging to start to think in terms of helpful and unhelpful emotions, because they're not always the same thing as positive and negative emotions or pleasant and unpleasant emotions. So the key to differentiating between them is, a helpful emotion is one that reflects the reality of the situation and enables you to make a decision going forward. An unhelpful emotion is one that is self-defeating or other-defeating and gets you stuck in the negativity of that experience. So what I was thinking we could do right now, we do have dry erase markers. So I'd like people to throw out some emotions, and as a group, see if you can decide if they fall into the helpful or unhelpful category. Keeping in mind that context is everything, so some of them will be a little bit fuzzy. Ready, go.
That Inside Out movie where they show that sadness can be helpful because it helps you have empathy for others.
Awesome example.
So
we're going to have two categories. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm not the instructions. So we're doing self-defeating, self-promoting?
Yep.
So
self-defeating over
here.
Okay. It's very much context-based, so this is, be very, very flexible on how you look at this. Don't take a picture of this list and carry it around to decide how you're feeling.
You must not.
Okay, sadness, another one that would, either one. What's that?
Anger.
Anger is what?
Well,
see, anger.
You broke our system already.
That it's a defeating emotion always.
It's it's on. It's on.
Yep. It seems like it's now.
No, we don't suppress it. We just mute it, and we replace it with annoyance, frustration, or sadness.
Let's talk about where anger comes from Misha's point of view.
this is true. I mean, anger is one of those that I think is the hot button emotion in the different theories in psychotherapy. This is one that lots of different subfields and theories argue over. Some people are really like, yes, embrace your emotion.
Anger forms the belief that someone's hurting me, and I need to pay attention. That someone's hurting me so much that I haven't been paying attention to the pain. Anger says, no, really, deal with this. I motivate you to deal with it.
When you're actually dealing with it, do you think that you're still sitting in the anger?
No, I move on, but it's self-promoting because it does them. It's like an alarm. If it's a fire alarm come off here, are we going to say, oh, those are the angels that are hurting our ears? No, but they tell us to meet up with those angels that are hurting our ears.
Well, I would say that alarm is, and this is, I want to have this dialogue, because I think that, and at the end of it, we're never going to solve this, and we're never all going to come to a consensus. Sure.
I think we're saying that you're thinking, like, our relatives or our agencies are taking it.
Frustration and irritation would be like we're going to ignore the smoke coming in, and which is frustration. You know, we're not going to wait until the alarms go off, which is anger. Is that right? Or
And I think that so. I have yet to meet, and granted, there's probably somebody who's been doing this way longer than me, and I might meet them. But I've yet to meet someone who makes decisions that are helpful while they're in their anger. But when we have moved into frustration or annoyance or sadness, then I've seen them be able to make some decisions that are helpful in their life.
But the fact that it may just be the natural path to frustration, I mean, you can't get to frustration without going through anger or something, seems like it serves a useful purpose. Like, kind of like a shoe.
That's so Lars
and
talks
that you
about,
can't circumvent it, Meg. I mean, there's
so Lars when he so he had maybe I didn't tell this story, but he had a family member that struggled with alcohol abuse, and it made him really angry. And every time he was with him, he drank a lot, and he was mean. And he was abusive to his family. And that was it made him angry to think, like, gosh, my brother makes these bad decisions around drinking and makes horrible decisions in the way that he relates to his family. And, you know, look at our relationship. It's not good. And he worked with Albert Ellis on this very emotion. And in about a half an hour of going really talking about what that anger was doing, he was able to change that anger into sadness, and he was then able to say, I cannot control my brother, and when I'm angry at my brother, that does not help our relationship, but when I'm sad for my brother, I can love him, and I can accept him a lot easier than when I'm angry. And for him, that was self-promoting. That's one of the most poignant examples I've seen of that, of replacing that anger with sadness. For every time after that, he thought about it, and he said, still, when I think about it, I only get sad.
But it seems like it's almost an instinctual emotion that they didn't even have non-human animals. You know, so to say, I don't know, to kind of label it bad, or defeating bad.
I think, again, right, defeating is a lot like irrational. It's not one that I would say, like, this is making you defeat yourself or you're being irrational. Just, is this helping you? If it's not, let's move on. Because you being angry, you're stewing in it.
Well, it seems like I can see myself, like, being, I don't get angry much, but it seems like injustice. That's one of the three things that makes me angry. I don't get just like angry person. It's the idea of a situation that is injustice.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And do something to make this a more
And I can totally relate because there's so many things that are unjust and it makes me angry. And then I work and say, and this is, and I'm no means perfect at it. I get angry all of the time. But when I'm able to kind of talk to myself and go, like, is that, what is that doing? What am I doing in that anger? I'm just yelling about it, or I'm upset and it's not doing anything to help the situation. Because and I think it goes back to, I think how it ties in is when you're saying you're making, like, this injustice, this outside thing is making me angry. That would, Albert Ellis would say that's not true. It's your thinking about it, because you're saying they must not do that. They cannot act in that way. Well, boo, they just did. They just did do that. So you being angry, like, they just did it, you know. And so I think that's what he would say. And so, right, and saying, like, I'm so, like, that's so frustrating, I'm so disappointed in that, but you, the system, or you, the individual, or you, the whatever, can do whatever it is. I don't get to control that. And so when I say, you're making me angry, or this injustice is making me angry, it's the way that we've conceptualized it, in that must. You must not do that, because it's bad, or you're bad.
Now, the mediator in me wants to acknowledge that anger is a great alarm system, and it does move us to action. And trying to find that middle ground, for me, it says if you stay in the anger and if you don't find the motivator underneath the anger, whether that's that sense of justice or whether that's pain or whatever else, then your actions are not going to be as helpful to you, because anger, when acted with anger, just leads to more anger from the other side, right? But touche.
I think that we assume that he was angry, and I don't know that he was. I think that he was so hurt to see that disrespect in his temple. He said, "This is the only way I can communicate to you." But again, that's an interpretation, right? Like, we could go all day with that. Yeah, in the back.
Misha, I think that's a good
distinction.
I'm going to cut in for just a second.
Yeah.
The recording's not going to pick up all the great comments if you don't have the microphone. So if you want to make a comment, if you would raise your hand so I can get the mic.
Sorry, Alice, we're going rogue. Sorry, up here maybe. And then here.
You had one right here.
Okay, here and then here.
Yeah, one of the things I was going to say is that I've always seen anger as a mask. There's always something behind it. And right now down in St. George, there's a whole big thing of we should change the name of Dixie State University. And there's so much vitriol and hatred and unhappiness. When people express their anger, there's no understanding. It becomes defeating and creates a separation between people. But when you feel that anger, if you can take that moment to say, oh, I'm feeling angry, what's behind it? What is the actual emotion I'm feeling? Is it hurt? Is it frustration? Is it, you know, what is it? Once you can say, I'm feeling frustrated, or I'm feeling hurt, then there can be a conversation. So I see anger itself as something that can defeat both my moving forward, because it can make me defensive, or it can make me myopic. We get tunnel vision sometimes when we're angry. But if you can look at what's behind that mask of anger, then those things can be promoting, because then we speak from really the core of what we're feeling.
I think that's a great comment. Sir, did you have a comment?
I've got a question. Where does frustration come up there?
So frustration would be over here.
So if I say to you now, I'm frustrated because I came here to get instructed from you folks, not to spend time trying to guess either the behaviors,
uh-huh,
or which side they go on,
uh-huh,
that's a good side. So I, when I'm frustrated, that's good, right?
That can be helpful in that it's better to be frustrated and saying, like, there's something that I am wanting that I'm not getting, so what can I do about it? And so you could ask, can you guys just move it along? Can you whatever? But if you're angry, you're maybe going to just storm out of the room, or you're going to yell. But
I thought that's just what I did.
You did, and message received.
And we are. And anger is one of those ones that, like, that's debated all the time in psychotherapy among therapists. So, and one of the strategies for how Albert Ellis interacted with clients was sometimes it was frustrating for people because he would do a lot of like kind of guess what I'm thinking, and that was not super helpful. So we will not do that anymore, and let's move. We'll keep moving it along.
I actually can't promise we won't do that anymore. We probably
will. That's true.
So this is just a very small incomplete list, but and I'm not actually sure I want to spend any more time on this topic. There, we'll move on, but we will leave it up. As you think about these, consider it in terms of, is this particular emotion in general, keeping in mind that context really matters, is this emotion going to help my situation, or is it going to get me stuck? Right?
And the thing I noticed, if you take it any basic psychology, is the unhelpful stuff is all coming from the amygdala and from the primitive brain, from the fight or flight, from that part that isn't really that prefrontal cortex where you're making executive decisions and you're thinking and you're planning. So if you're stuck back here where you either want to fight or flight or hide or freeze, you're not going to go forward. But I see the helpful ones as things where you're actually engaged in thinking and this part of your brain rather than in the primitive part.
Great. Yeah, that's a great addition of the kind of the neuroscience behind it, which as you describe it, makes perfect sense to me. So when we're using that frontal lobe, we tend to have some of the more helpful emotions, such as concern, disappointment. Disappointment, by the way, huge one. Disappointment gets masked by anger quite a bit in terms of this language, right? Anything else on this one? Have you had enough time to kind of look at it?
We can make them available. Mm-hmm. I would say there's also some positive emotions that aren't helpful, like a lot of grandiosity or pride. These things can be correlated with, like, narcissism, and that is not usually helpful, to think that you're just, like, the best ever, and that's not psychologically, promoting of well-being either. So it's not just the negative emotions. But we all know not a lot of narcissists come to therapy for their narcissism, so mainly we end up with the negative ones.
And the other problem with that is if you have some standard for yourself that determines whether you're good enough and you meet that standard most of the time, that's great as long as you're meeting that standard. But eventually, most of us come across something that we fail at. And it's in those moments where having that standard that determines your worth or your value or whatever language you want to use becomes problematic for you. All right, so let's talk about some church stuff, since that's kind of why we're here. How we want to go about this. So as you think about some of the stuff that you've heard taught in the Mormon church, or you've been taught yourself in a Mormon context, you can probably come up with contradictions on just about any topic out there, right? That's part of the thing that brings people to a sunstone type world, is that recognition that life is really complex and things aren't as simple and black and white as maybe we'd like to believe sometimes. For example, these are some mediocre ones that I came up with on the spot. The first is, we've got this teaching, for dust thou art and unto dust thou shalt return. You're dust. And at the same time, God tells us the worth of souls is great to him. How do we fit those things together? A lot of times there's not a clear answer on that, although I'm sure some of you very intelligent people could come up with one. But the point becomes that in a lot of cases, you have a little bit of leeway in how you see these things. You can choose to focus on the teachings that make you feel down, make you feel like you're not enough, make you feel like everything is just going to go horribly for you. Or you can choose to focus on the teachings that build you up, that self-promote. Where else do we want to go with that? I'm really eager to get to the part where you guys break out and talk to each other, so I'm not wanting to spend too much time on all of this right now.
Yeah, I think it's just important that for every be perfect even as I am, there's another teaching or principle that can be replaced, that we can spend a little more of our time focused on. We get to choose what we focus our energy and our time on and our thoughts on. And that gives us power to start being in charge of our lives and driving the bus instead of saying, see, like the scriptures say we're dust. Well, the scriptures also say that your worth is great. So which one is more true, which one is not true, but which one do you choose to, which one is helpful? Which one's helpful for you right now in the situation where you are?
And keep in mind, they both have their uses. There's a reason
absolutely
why they're both there.
And it could be contextual.
So the REBT philosophy reminds me a lot of Buddhist teachings. Was he influenced at all by Buddhism or anything like that? Because it just seems remarkably similar.
There is no strong evidence of that, although there is a rumor that at one point he was working on a book co-authoring with another person on some of those correlations. Where he was fairly strongly influenced, as far as I know, is by Stoicism, and there's a lot of parallels between Stoicism and Buddhism. I can't say that one actually led to the other. If it did, it would be Buddhism leading to Stoicism, but I think the more likely truth is that when you get to the core of it, there is a lot in common with all of these different models.
And I think truth comes, and it comes from different places, and sometimes it comes in a little bit different package, but truth is truth, and I think we recognize it, and so we can recognize it when we hear it coming from the Dalai Lama or ancient Tibetan teachings, or we recognize it when we hear it in our psychotherapy, or we recognize it when we're reading our scriptures. And truth can come through, I think, and sometimes we're able to hear it based on our context, our personality in one way and not in another. So this is another way to bring, you know, bring an opportunity and to facilitate someone learning some truth. And if we can get people to know of the truth that they have worth and value, I think lots of languages would speak to that. Languages broadly.
I'm glad you brought that up, though, because my training background is in Buddhist philosophy. My master's degree was all meditation, Buddhism-type stuff. And that was really what drew me to this REBT model, was that it fit really well with some of the stuff I'd already been using. Okay. Go ahead. As soon as the mic gets to you.
I just want to see what your recommendation is on kind of that list of scriptures that I assume you picked because they could incite like some of these self-promoting or defeating feelings in people. And then at the bottom it says, so which do you believe? So I'm curious your recommendation about when we read these things that we examine how they make us feel and then determine is that defeating or is that self-promoting and then choose to believe it or not? Or is your recommendation that, like, do we believe it and then determine the emotions afterwards? Or I'm just trying to kind of like fit maybe like explicitly
we're going to talk how to apply the model. And it's an ABC model. We have our activating event, we have our belief, and then we have our consequent emotion. So we're going to talk about how we go back and dispute that belief and replace it with a new belief. And that's how, we practice it. And we're going to practicing it, actually, through an imagery exercise. So
yeah, we might be a little ahead of ourselves here. So maybe let's jump to that. So you're all going to get to use this in a second, so pay attention here. The ABC model is used all over the psychology world. It is not at all unique to REBT, although pretty sure it started there, so if that means anything to you. Now, go ahead with this one.
Okay.
How do you teach it?
So, we have an activating event. We have something that happens, and then we usually, because it's hard to, what Albert Ellis would say is that parsing this out is really just so that we can slow things down and work through them, but we're always like feeling, thinking at the same time. We're like, it's going like this all of the time. We're thinking and we're feeling and we're leaving and then we're quickly doing, and whether that doing is a thought or a word or an action, those, they're very hard to, when you're in the moment, but slowing down and, you know, and kind of parsing them out is part of the process of how you dispute and replace. So we have something that happens, okay? Let's say, what do we want to happen?
Well, I'll use myself as an example.
Use yourself.
So I had
your day-to-day.
Yeah, my day-to-day today. I had a client today who she had been seeing another therapist for a while, and he moved on and transferred her to me. And at her first appointment, she completely no-showed. So we gave her a call. She said, oh, shoot, I forgot about it. We rescheduled for later the same day because I had an open slot. She came. We met. It went great. Scheduled for another appointment today. And for the second time, basically in a row, she no-showed on me. That's my A.
So your client no-showed second time. How are you feeling?
Pretty bad.
Pretty bad. Okay.
I hadn't used the ABC model yet, so I was sitting in my self pity, actually.
You were feeling pity.
I was feeling bad for myself.
What do you think you were saying to yourself about that?
I was saying to myself, "Wow, I'm a pretty bad therapist because this person had never missed any appointments until she got transferred to me, and then two in a row.
So it must be me. Clearly.
Clearly, it was Misha. No, it was me.
It was Tristan. So Tristan's feeling, he recognizes his emotion. He's feeling pity. He's feeling down on himself. And then he can go back and he sees his thought. And his thought is that, well, it must be me. And what does that mean? That I must be a bad therapist. Why is that bad?
Because I determine my worth based on how good of a therapist I am.
Mm-hmm. Your worth in your job, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If I'm not a good therapist, then I won't get a good job as a therapist in the future, and then I'll be poor and probably homeless. And then,
eventually we get to living in a cardboard box under the freeway, right, if we keep carrying this on. So if we can go back and say, what are some other things? Let's examine the evidence, okay? So you've never seen this client before, or you had seen her before?
I had seen her once.
Just once. Okay.
She no-showed. I saw her. She no-showed.
Okay. Oh. I didn't hear that. I guess I didn't recognize.
Yeah, she even met me and still no-showed.
And still no-showed. Oh. So, that's not what we would want to happen. But how do you know that it's because you're a bad therapist and because she obviously, thinks you're a bad therapist. Where's the evidence that that's true?
I have no evidence that that's true.
Okay. Exactly. There's no evidence that that's true.
She also mentioned the one time that we did meet that she's not very good with schedules and she's very forgetful.
So there's evidence to the contrary, actually. So could it possibly, what could, based on the evidence that you do have, that it's something to the contrary, then other than you're a bad therapist, what's another possibility?
She's a bad client.
That's right. That's the right answer. That's what Albert Ellis would absolutely say. So she's a bad client.
The truth is probably that it had nothing to do with me. That this is probably something that just happens in her life.
Maybe. Now, what if it were true that you were a bad therapist?
Then I would feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
but I would probably get over it because sometimes I feel like I'm a good therapist.
So some days you feel like you're a good therapist.
Some days I do.
So what do you know about the statistics on therapists?
I'm guessing, I don't know. Some of them are good and some are bad.
Mm-hmm. Most tend to be mediocre.
I can take mediocre. I'm okay being a mediocre therapist.
So that last little part, where CBT would say, all the evidence suggests that this isn't the case. And REBT goes, well, what if it is? What if you are crappy? And we would continue, and I would continue to push and push Tristan to eventually, when he makes an evaluation on his value and worth as a person, because that's always where it's going to go. It's going to go back to that place. If we go, really, what is it that you're really, really scared about? It's really that I'm scared about not being good enough. And being a good therapist is just another way that I can reassure myself that I'm valuable and I'm worth something. I've not seen it not get back to there if we would go, you know, have our 45-minute session. Does everyone understand how this works? And the evidence, kind of like in society, is that the same things happen to different people and people react differently. People have different emotional outcomes. People have different thoughts. People process things differently. So if it were that it was awful, that the thing was awful and the thing was causing you to be disturbed, then everyone that happened to would be disturbed. Every single therapist who's ever had someone come and or no-show come and then no-show again would have the exact same thought, and that's just not the thing. I never go there. I always just go to, they're flighty or whatever, because, no. That's right, they need therapy.
So this is what I've been waiting for. So we want you all to try it now. So if you could get into some small groups, 2, 3, I don't care how many, what we want you to do is help each other to find an activating event and follow it to the consequence that came up. We're not going to take it quite yet all the way to disputing and coming up with alternatives. Right now, all you're doing is naming the event, talking about the way it made you feel, and then getting to those beliefs that kind of bridged the two.
Can you guys see? Can you see these? Here? Okay. Am I self-rating? This is human rating. Thank you. Am I human rating, okay? Am I saying that I'm a good or a bad person based on this thing? This is usually how we determine what your belief is. It comes out in these ways. Is this demanding? Am I using language like I have to, should, must, ought, better? Instead of saying something like, I would like to, hope to, wish to, desire to, prefer to, okay? Am I catastrophizing? This is awful, terrible, I'm going to be poor under the bridge. It's going to be awful. And then a bird is going to poop on my head. So these questions here can be helpful for identifying what it is you're believing about it. This is where your distress is coming from this B. Okay? So get together. I know it's like, but it'll be.
Interaction.
That is correct, Adam Fisher. You do not have to. Yes, you would. You would be better off. You would not be better, but you'd be better off, my man.
We would really like you to. If you get stuck, just raise your hand and one of us will come help you out with it. All right, has everybody had a chance to at least get through their ABC part? Okay, well, preferably start with your own. All right, so I'll give you 1.5 minutes. 1.5 more minutes. All right, so hopefully by now you're all experts at recognizing your unhelpful emotions, finding the triggering event, and finding the core beliefs underneath that. All right, so is anyone willing to share what they learned with the whole room? All right, so let's start with the activating event. What happened?
I
Okay, so Zed was talking about looking for a job. So he's had a seasonal job. It's ended. He's looking for a new job.
All right.
He's been told that he's very qualified, but he didn't make it, and he's had 6 rejections.
All right, so 6 rejections. All right. And then what happened?
How did you feel
when you had the 6 rejections? How have you been feeling about it?
It's hard when that happens. I just want to go on Facebook and play one of the games on there.
And why do you want to do that?
It's a way to run away from the feelings.
Which ones?
Oh, inadequacy.
Ah, that was easy. We already gave you that answer. Okay, great.
Because what? If you were what, then you would have what?
If I was higher qualified, then, I realize it's only 6 jobs that I've got the reply back for, where they do say I'm qualified for the job, but not the most highly qualified. So, run away from the feeling that that I'm not good enough for that position, even though that's what I've been training for.
So you're doing a little bit of RBT on your own there, just a little bit. But if you were to, being underqualified, that might be true. So what if it were true that you're underqualified and that is the reason that you haven't got this was the reason that you got these 6 jobs? How does that belief, because that seems like pretty reasonable, how does that belief lead to inadequacy, feeling inadequate as a person?
I think it would come from inadequacy as a person. The belief that there might be other people with the same qualifications that for some reason they're tweaking their resume the right way, where they're getting it, or they're answering the questions.
They know something you don't know about how to do this?
Right. And
so they're better than you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In reality, it probably comes down to higher experience or higher education.
So if it were to come down to higher experience, higher education, qualification, work, I don't know that you'd be feeling inadequate. I think you would be feeling underprepared. I think you'd be feeling frustrated by the fact that you're underprepared or that people are cheating the system or that people have more training. But it seems like to get to inadequacy, there's some belief in there about you feeling as a person that you're not good enough. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where we would go. Because I'm going, you're underqualified. Well, maybe that's true. You might be. Someone might be cheating. You could maybe use more education but how does that lead to inadequacy? Because inadequacy, that's a big one. That's heavy. That's heavy. That's self-defeating for sure. And that's where we would continue to go into that until we got there, and then you'd be all crying. I would crack a joke and it would be all right.
Not everyone cries.
Yeah, not everyone cries, which is fine. Do we want to get a couple more or do we want to move on?
Let's move on because we're low on time. Still in your groups, if you haven't already started, moving into the disputation portion of it and getting to the yeah, so let me read it so you can see it. On the D it says, dispute vigorously and rigorously challenge the irrational belief. And then some of the questions you can ask that are really helpful are, where is the evidence? Does this make sense? Does this help me? And what could I say instead? And then you go into the E, which is the emotional effect. You say, now that I've disputed, how do I feel about A? What's different about my feelings in this situation?
So Zed, if you were to really believe that, I know you might not, but if you were, pretend we really believe this. If you were to really believe that it had nothing to do with you, but it had to do with like your training or your qualification, how do you think you would feel? So you would feel disappointed. We can do something with that. We can do something with disappointed. It's still negative, but we can do something with it. And you would then go and seek maybe more training, more opportunities, but instead in that inadequacy feeling, you're playing video games. That's how it works. So we're replacing, and we're saying, like, I know you don't believe it yet, because the first time it doesn't, But just to get a little glimpse, how would you feel? Maybe, how would you, we're going to be curious. What would it be like to be, you know, to believe that it was these other things and not your value? And then we practice that over and over again. And we track it. And we send these little worksheets home with people and they write down their little things, right? We keep practicing it until it is a real belief. And then the next time this happens, hopefully it won't happen again, next time it happens or next time something else happens, we have the tools and we're equipped to know how to replace that self-defeating emotion with one that's more promoting.
Anything else? All right, so take a few minutes and do that with each other, with the event that you've already talked about. Start going into the disputing part. Help each other to come up with good disputations and good things to say instead.
So again, what's the evidence? Does it make sense? Does it help me? What could I say instead? The what could I say instead is helpful for getting a concrete replacement.
All right, time is up. I hope you successfully solved all of your problems. How'd it go? Time is up. It's over. All right, so we're going to finish up here with a chance for you to ask some more questions and have some more lively conversation. But this is a process that you can and may benefit from doing every day. All you have to do is take yourself through those same steps. Think of an event that got you worked up and then sit with that feeling. And just sit with it for a few minutes till you really are in it. And then will yourself to think of it differently, just like you did here. And it's maybe not going to feel very natural at first, and it's maybe not going to last very long. You might just get a glimpse of it for a moment. But my guess is that if you did it every day for a month, you'll probably start to see some changes with it. And you just have to do that with every single problem you have for the rest of your life. Simple.
And again, I want to emphasize that, you know, we can do this with secular examples, but we can also do it with religious examples. And if you're not black and you can't say my joke, then all you have to do is say black and die. A lot of clients who are a little bit more who are maybe a little less religiously scrupulous. And they can kind of, you'll feel it out and see if what kind of sense of humor they have, right? But if you can get away with, like, well, what is the name of the scriptures? You have to go to the celestial kingdom. And they're not.
Tie this to me, anyway. Tie this to the gospel.
Absolutely. So these same truths, these same principles are in both. And so when you're in doing therapy with someone or you're thinking of it yourself, you can use a secular example like there's nothing I have to do because I only have to live and breathe and die. Or you could say, well, I don't have to go to the celestial kingdom, so I surely don't have to do my homework. I want to go to the celestial kingdom. That's what I want to do. And it feels like less of a burden when it's, I don't have to, I guess, huh? I only want to. Absolutely. And one of the scriptures that Tristan put up was in Mark 10. And this is, so one of the things you could ask is, like, do you know any good people? And almost any time you say, do you know any good people? They'll say yes. And then you say, well, Jesus said he didn't know any good people. Because when he was called good master, he said, why are you calling me good? There's only one good. That's Father God. Said, I'm not good. That's not a child for me. So if Christ didn't even think of himself as good, then you don't know any good people. And so if the dialectic reasoning would tell us that there's no good people, there's no bad people. We're all just people. And sometimes we're in a better situation. Sometimes we're doing things that are helpful for us. We can always be better off, but we can't be better. That's a religious support for this idea of this inherent worth and value. That there's nothing that you can do that's going to make you good, and nothing that you can do that's going to make you bad. You just are. Sometimes we make good decisions, sometimes we make bad decisions. That's just life. And sometimes those lead to consequences that are hard, but that doesn't make you bad.
Way to the temple interview questions. Mm-hmm. Then you're worthy. That's when you're worthy. Mm-hmm. And so then you can conclude that if you can't answer correctly to those, then you're not worthy. You're not valuable.
Right.
And that it is. And so I think it's very widespread. It doesn't really matter what any particular. You can cherry pick the scriptures that say you're worth $1 million. But the cultural message.
Right, absolutely. And that's what you. And that's why we work on what we believe. Do I believe that this man sitting across from me, this my neighbor who is the postman, gets to tell me what my worth is? Do I really believe that? He gets to sign a piece of paper to say what activity I get to participate in, but that's not my worth. Going to the temple isn't my worth. It's an activity that it's a religious ritual that I participate in. But it's certainly not my worth. It's certainly not what God has said about me. Oh, all the time. That's why they're trying to kick me out of my ward. But I won't go. So, because I say stuff like that all the time. Like, I'm not going to let the postman or the chiropractor tell me what I'm worth when I believe that, that's not helpful. What's helpful for me? What's helpful for me and my well-being is for me to believe that God gave me an inherent worth and value. And that even if you say I'm not worthy to go and do this religious ritual, that's okay. I'm not worthy to go do that religious ritual. Exactly.
That word worthy is kind of problematic, right?
It is. Should get rid of it in our culture.
Or at least understand better what it really means.
There's my shoulding.
So I'm going to say more of the same thing, but anyone who has spent much time at BYU or really in Mormon culture of any sort knows that it's full of people who are full of anxiety, full of fear about where they're going to end up when they die, full of depression because they don't feel like they're going in the right direction. And to me, that is a shame because what we have in this church is a gospel that teaches us about the love of Christ, which is perfect and is unconditional and doesn't require us to meet some standard. We are all trying to work toward perfection. We are all hoping that we get there in the end, but we do not expect ourselves to be there right now. And this, what we've been talking about today, hopefully helps people to recognize that that's the truth of it. We are all imperfect beings. We're neither good nor bad. We're just doing the best we can, and that means sometimes we make mistakes. But that's the whole point of the atonement in the first place, right? We're allowed to make these mistakes, and we're allowed to continually work toward perfection, knowing that that's taken care of, that God loves us regardless of
that. And again, being better, you could argue that being in the celestial kingdom would be better off than being in the celestial kingdom. I don't think God loves his children in the celestial kingdom, and they have more worth or value than his children in the celestial kingdom. Maybe better off. You might have a bigger house. You might live next door to the Pope and Mother Teresa, and that'd be cool. But that is not required to have the love of God and of the Savior. Yes. Last comment. Sorry.
Therapy. So when you, even if the example of the church culture, do you feel like it's ever appropriate to validate? Like, it's normal for you to feel inadequate because this is the culture that you live in, the one that you've been taught to believe these things. Because it sounds like a lot of what you're doing is challenging people's beliefs, which totally makes sense and is great. But I think for me, a lot of my sense of worth has come when people say, wow, I totally get where you're coming from. If I were you, I'd react that same way or something like that. So I'm wondering if
you go through the ABC with the client, you accomplish that because you can say, oh, yeah, the way that you're looking at it, it makes perfect sense why you would feel this way right now. I would feel exactly the same way if this was my thought process with it.
Okay.
But what happens if we change a couple of the parameters here? Okay. How does it lead us to a different conclusion?
Right, when you say, yeah, oh, yeah, that... You know, where you're thinking there, where you're believing, yeah, that would I would be upset too. I mean, and again, this acceptance, right? Like that, the acceptance of others. I mean, building rapport and a relationship is not left out the door of REBT. And that's important to me, and I usually do that with, you know, through humor or whatever else. And so that people, you know, feel like, yeah, I'm on your side. It just may not look exactly like how it would look in a client-centered room. But it's there, absolutely. Right. Whoever is a paying client is in need of therapy. Right, right. Exactly. So thank you guys so much. I know it was the end of the day, but we appreciate you guys being here.
Yeah, thank you.